I'm actually shut it. We do that for all the dieways.
We actually do that.
We do perpendicular with not nearly a climate level, but then what they do is they move back from the tower and put it into the main telescope.
Yeah, it turns out that when you read the Roan catalog on towers, among others, it would lead you to believe that the tower was out of true by a tenth of a degree, and that the ground around the tower is not perfectly flat, and every one of the guy wires is the exact same distance away from the base of the tower, and every one of them is the exact same length, and you're violating all their rules, and therefore they are thoroughly innocent if any kind of a failure occurs. You and I have seen towers in a mountain, inside of a mountain, where no two guy wires are the same length. I've seen many an installation where the guy wires are not exactly the same distance away from the base, the point of construction, and a point of connection to the earth anchor system. I use earth screw anchors, by the way. On my property, on normal soil, a 8-inch Archimedes screw anchor on the end of 5.5 feet of 1-inch diameter rod is good for more than 12,000 pounds of holding force. And I've got a backup system on those. In other words, I've got redundancy in that particular system. I don't want anyone's screw anchor pulling up or anyone guy wire failing to allow the tower to fall, is my theory. I don't have perfect safety in that particular area. But the tension on the guy wires, in my case, I'm using a 6M wire, which is quarter-inch diameter, extremely high-strength steel, ultimate strength of 6,650 pounds. I think each one of mine are stressed to roughly 1,800 pounds. And even that is not magic. When you study the way a tower deflects in a wind, you could have some of the guy wires a little bit different in tension. So if there's a little bit of a twist to the tower, a little bit of a non-straightness, and you would think that that's going to cause a collapse. You go through the study of the physics involved, and you'd have to do something pretty severe before that would allow a tower failure. So many of these restrictions on exact perpendicularity, exact straightness, exact distance of the earth mounting point of the guy wire from the base of the tower, the length of the guy wire, the tensions on the guy wire, there's a lot of leeway in these things. The main thing that you really care about is that the guy wires are approximately in the right position, approximately in the right strength, length, and tension, and that they stay there in the worst case condition of a Hurricane Gloria or a Hurricane Katrina or whatever. If those guy wires let go for any reason, your tower's in an awful lot of trouble. In my case, I have to add some extra protection because I've got lots of trees on my property, and in theory, a worst case fall over of a tree laying against the guy wire can give the guy wire quite a bit of grief. I've had that happen on one occasion. I've had a tree, a very heavy tree, fail and lay against the guy wire. And that particular guy wire gets stretched by, I think it was a foot or two, and I replaced it immediately. It kept its connections on both ends, but it just stretched because of the quite a few thousand pounds of tree laying against the guy wire. The tower itself took on a kind of a crooked look to it during that episode, but no other grief that I know about. The worst case situation I had is where I have 100 feet of my older tower is a Roan number 6, a fairly old, fairly unsubstantial tower by modern standards, and I'm guided at the 30, 50, 70, and 90 foot level. The top 10 feet of tower is unguided, and the top 10 feet of tower had a very large antenna before Hurricane Gloria came along. It was I don't know the exact number right now, but I'm at a guess, it was not only 15 to 20 square foot of antenna area was on top of that tower. Gloria hit me with something like 105 mile an hour wind, and the antenna became damaged, and the top of the tower got tilted, got bent at about a 30 degree angle. And I studied real hard, what am I going to use to straighten out the top tower section? I didn't have a replacement. Roan number 6 was a discontinued product, I couldn't buy it anymore, so I decided I was going to straighten out that section. And I looked real hard around the property, what have I got that's strong enough that I can mount a Roan tower section to and bend it back? And I rapidly came to the conclusion the strongest thing I had is the other 90 feet of tower that was below it. I straightened it out in position. In other words, I put extra safety guy wires on the tower, put an extra wire on the top section that was bent at a 30 degree angle. I stood on the ground with a come-along winch, block and tackle, and pull down that wire in the right direction for the right amount of time until the top section that was bent at a 30-degree angle came back to true. It worked. I've been using that one ever since. Gloria was, what, 1985? So I've got 22 years of further use of that particular tower section that I bent back in place. I don't recommend people do that. In my case, because of my particular procedure, I think it worked, and it's a, and in my case, by the way, the top 10 feet of the tower is not the most critical part. If at worst it fails, 10 feet of tower falls over against the upper, against the 90 feet that's below it, and my antenna that's on it gets lowered a few feet, so to speak. It doesn't have the ability to collapse the rest of the structure as long as it stays in place. And obviously what Mel was telling us earlier, the most dangerous thing you can do when constructing a tower that is, I'm going to pick a number, more than about 70 feet tall, you've got to be very careful that you don't drop a tower section while you're holding it up. When I go beyond the 70-foot level of the tower that I'm assembling, I use an auxiliary safety system, which consists of nylon webbing with the carabiners on the end of it, these snap-link hooks, so that when I'm above the 70-foot level, I'm holding up a tower section with block and tackle, and I've got a safety system on it, I make sure that this nylon webbing is connected between the tower section that's being hauled up and the standing tower. And I've got a pair of these, and I walk them up the tower as I'm doing the hauling. So if at worst the block and tackle hauling the tower up should disconnect, and the tower wants to fall, it can't fall any more than the 7 or 8 foot of length of that nylon webbing. And the nylon webbing is rated for 5,000 pounds of a steady state tension, and I think it can take a shock of even greater than that. I don't want a tower section to drop, because if it does, and it cuts through a guy wire, it'll collapse the whole tower with me on it, and I really don't want that to happen. Yeah. Okay, anyway, any further comments on this before we pass it back to Mel, K2RIW?
WS2N?
One more for me.
Okay, Paul and Eric in that order. Go ahead, Paul.
Now that tree weighed thousands of pounds. That hit the guy, and it didn't break it. With your tower, do you think your tower would break it? I mean, your tower's going to be a lot lighter than the tree. Are you worrying about maybe the edge, an edge, you know, actually cutting through the line? But I'm amazed that the tree didn't break it back either.
Okay, tower ratings are very different than you would think. My favorite tower these days is Roan 55. And what does the 55 mean? Each individual leg of the tower will tolerate a pure vertical force of 55,000 pounds. Each vertical leg, 55,000 pounds. If you could take a Roan 55 tower section, a 10 foot long, 18 inch on the side, and if you could load each three legs purely vertically, 55 times 3 is what? 165,000 pounds. A section of Roan 55, pure vertical loading, will take 165,000 pounds. Roan number 6, I am guessing, means that each individual leg will take 6,000 pounds of vertical loading. I was using guy wire that's only rated for 6,650 pounds. So the guy wire is tremendously weaker compared to the tower itself, if and only if the tower experiences pure vertical loading. Now, if you do something foolish, where you've got 100 feet of tower, and you allow the middle 50 feet to bow out to one side, and now you pull down real heavily on the top of that tower by extra tension on the guy wire, obviously the structure will buckle very fast. It takes very little weight to do that. So the main function of your guy wires is to make sure every one of the sections is directly above each other, that the tower, when you sight down one leg, they're all in a straight line. If you keep the tower in a pure straight line, pure vertical loading, it can take tremendous amounts of force. But you do something wrong where a guy wire somewhere in the middle of the tower is missing and it's able to bow out in one direction, that is the method of failure. Buckling is your main method of failure. Whenever an object has more than a 4-to-1 slenderness ratio, I can take a solid chunk of wood, which is more than 4-to-1 in slenderness ratio. In other words, if the width of the chunk of wood, take a 4x4 for instance, a 4x4 and 4 times that is roughly a foot and a half. If I got 2 feet of 4x4 wood, and I put it vertically in a perfect press. And then you press on it until it fails. It will fail at a 45-degree slanted angle, not counting some weird effects of the grain structure of the wood. If it was a uniform material, it would fail by shearing at a 45-degree angle. If it was shorter than a 4-to-1 ratio, beyond a 4-to-1 ratio, majority of the time it will fail by buckling. In other words, the middle will bow out in one direction. So in the case of almost any reasonable radio tower, we're way beyond the 4-to-1 slenderness ratio. Therefore, 99% of the time, the method of failure is buckling, bowing out in one direction, and that means your lower guy wires are the most important ones. They're the ones that stop the tower from buckling. You ask any reasonable ham radio operator, which guy wire is the most important? They'll tell you, oh, it's the top one. If the top one fails, the top 10 feet of tower folds over. The rest of it stands. If the bottom guy wire fails and the bottom 20 feet of tower bows out, everything will collapse into that bow. All of those other guy wires become slack. The whole structure becomes a pile of rubble, and maybe you're in the middle of it, and you ain't going to be happy about that. I think you see the picture of it, Paul. Back to you, Paul.
Okay, very, very good. Yeah, I just see the picture. And I agree, taking towers apart or anything apart, I don't know what you think, I think is always much more dangerous than assembling something. Putting up a tower, I think, everything has got a certain element of danger, but I think taking apart towers, being in construction, we saw tons and tons, miles and miles of pipe in buildings throughout, everywhere, and vertically, horizontally, on 45s. When it came to renovation work and taking things apart, I find that much more dangerous than installing things for a lot of different fields, and towers qualified back here.
You're absolutely right. Because of what people do, taking apart a tower is much more dangerous because they assume it's simple. It's very similar to a guy running up a set of stairs or running down a set of stairs. He assumes that running down the set of stairs is going to be tremendously easier. And there's some physics involved that make that a complicated issue. Taking down a tower because people skip the individual steps and don't understand the physics involved can get them into a tremendous amount of trouble, without a doubt. But if you understand what you're doing, there should be no difference in assembling versus disassembling. Now, one of the crazy things that I do, before I climb any one of my towers, I do it as a confidence-building maneuver. I also do it as some kind of a double check. I go to each and every guy wire of the tower. I grab it about 7 feet above the ground, and I hang my full weight on that guy wire. And I watch what happens. I do that to each and every guy wire before I climb any tower that has guy wires. I do it both to convince myself that all the equipment has got reasonable integrity. I give it a visual inspection, but I hang my weight on every guy wire before I climb. Because my weight hanging in that guy wire in that manner, assuming I weigh 200 pounds, because of the way I'm creating a catenary tension on the wire, probably in some cases adding 300 pounds of extra tension on that guy wire. And if it can take that, and the tower doesn't do anything unreasonable, most likely the structure has a significant amount of integrity, then if I've got a good safety belt mechanism between my body and that tower, with duplication, I wear a chest harness and a waist harness. The chest harness and the waist harness are connected to each other with nylon webbing. I've got from the chest harness, I've got a lanyard that goes around the tower. From the waist harness, I've got a lanyard around the tower. I've got redundancy in the system. A person who will hang his body at the 100-foot level of the tower with one single lanyard around the tower, and he leans back on that, and his hands are not holding his weight on the tower, he's using his two hands for doing the work he's doing. In my opinion, he's got no backup, he's got no safety, and that's a foolish way to do it. When I'm on station, there are two lanyards. There's a redundancy to that system because I don't like dropping 100 feet. I can envision what will happen. Almost every tool I own has been dropped from my tower. Most of my radios at one time or another have been dropped from my tower, and I see what happens. I don't want it to happen to me. By the way, even my glasses have been dropped from the tower, and now we're landed around the back of my head to make sure the glasses can't come off. think I told you one day, I was so excited on what I was doing, and it was a windy day. I realized in the middle of the job I was having trouble focusing on what I was doing. As I climbed down the bottom of the tower, I found my glasses sitting on the ground. They didn't break. They had landed safely in the bushes, so to speak. And so I didn't even know, because I was so busy, that they had blown off my head. So all kinds of funny things can happen because you're concentrating on other things. You're very motion sensitive when you're on a tower. You're also burning adrenaline like you wouldn't believe. When I do any substantial amount of tower work, I can measure how hard I've worked by what the scale in the bathroom tells me, by how many pounds I've lost when I do a couple of days worth of work on the tower. And you wouldn't think you're exerting that much horsepower. I think a lot of it's adrenaline flow and moisture loss and sweating and worrying and whatever. But there's a lot of things that people should do with a tower that they don't do. Most of what people wear as a safety harness, by my standards, is extremely inadequate. It's just a so-called Aflami belt, is what the mountaineers will call it. A simple thing around the waist with some kind of an attachment to the tower. And most guys, when they're climbing, are unattached. And if you think about it carefully, you realize there's only one handhold between you and some kind of a disaster. I climb with two lanyards around the tower. When I come to a guy station, I disconnect one from below the guy wire section. I then reconnect it above the guy wire section back to my body before disconnecting the lower one. So at most of the time during the climb, I'm connected to the tower twice. There's a short period of time when I'm only connected to the tower once when I'm passing a set of guy wires. Yes, it takes me some extra time to climb a tower, but I've now owned substantial towers since 1967. I've owned 60-foot and above level towers, and I've done lots of climbing, put millions of antennas on them over all those years. Let's see, 67 to now is 40 years. I got 40 years of experience of 4,200-foot towers on my property, lots of antenna changes, lots of climbs per year, and so far, no major disasters. And I think it's some of these procedures I'm describing that makes some of the difference. And you have to understand the physics involved. When in doubt, read about it. And the best book I know, every good technical library's got, the National Association of Broadcasters Handbook, and read the section on tower construction and tower maintenance. Beautifully well written. You get a little bit of information from the Rhone catalog, but they're afraid, the Rhone tower company, they're afraid to give you too much information for fear that if you follow it word for word and make a mistake, that they're going to get sued. You got to be careful what you read there. But they do supply some pretty nice safety equipment. I wonder, what's the tallest structure you've ever climbed, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW, the TechNet. K2IW,
KE2EJ. Oh, let's see. I've been up on 300, 400, 500-foot towers. That's high enough for me. I mean, what's really cool is going on top of the CN tower and looking through the glass floor and watching people get vertical and stand over. Actually, I've been up on the transmitting portion of the CN tower where the stick is, where all the antennas are, and that's quite interesting. But that's cheating. You take an elevator up there. You kind of covered what I was going to bring up before in terms of vertical loading. But the one thing that I will point out is that my tower here, which is 195 feet, the bottom portion of the tower is interesting compared to, say, a low, where you basically have a flat plate that's mounted in some form of cement base and goes down 4 or 5 feet. This tower comes to a ball. It looks like a ball bearing, a big ball bearing. It's got a cup that's about, it's a little less than a foot big. And the entire vertical weight of the entire antenna sits on this little ball. Sort of like when you put a ballpoint pen to a paper, but it has a little cup that conforms to the ball, keep it from flipping out. But to think about all that weight coming down to one little point in terms of the vertical loading of the tower, the bottom, that little bottom section, which is maybe about 2 feet in height, and it's a combination of bolts and welds, and to think that that stays put is quite an amazing feat. I've gotten to the point, I've been up to the top of this tower, insurance-wise, that's just and you were talking about safety belts when we were building these DCD antennas on the World Trade Center. guys basically, they're more into skyscraper construction, but the short-term guys would use a double safety harness. Consider it a safety harness because it has the loops on the lens loops behind you and in front of you, so that way it can take you a bit of a weight. It's really a safety harness from where you need to fall, as opposed to the loops that you have around the waist, you know, the combination harness. And basically, they were part of a block and tackle, and they were hoisted up and down. So the long term, they had this little thing that they sat in, sort of a three-sided, a chair, you could think of it, with this little quarter-inch guy wire up on the top of the World Trade Center, while the wind is blowing, watching them swing from left to right, you know, until they finally said they had enough. I don't know how these guys do it, but they do amazing things. Even when I just changed the guy wires on this tower about a year ago, because they've been up there for like 35 years, and the rush was beginning to show, and we decided, let's do it now rather than wait, to go from the safety point. But unbelievably, the cables have not stretched that much over the years, but we decided it was time to do it, so we did. And to watch those guys work is just an amazing thing. They would attach new guy wires first, get the tension, make sure it's level, everything was right before they would, go near an existing one to loosen it up.
I wish I had known that replacement had taken place. I would have liked to have watched that operation. That thing that they hold them up with, I think it's called a bosun's chair, and people on ships use those to get to the top of the mast, and there's lots of ways you can get in trouble with the way you use one of those things. And on top of the World Trade Center, with all that wind being called up that 300-foot tower, wow. You really need a tagline on that man to control the amount of sway. He shouldn't just be floating free on a windy day, otherwise he can be slammed into that tower kind of mercilessly. Another point I was going to make here. Oh, yes. The ball that's at the bottom of your tower is called a zero-moment base. And here's my understanding of that. My old Row number 6 tower, which is not very substantial, is guided at 30, 50, 70, and 90 feet. When I'm standing at the 100-foot level, and I sway, I push my body away and toward the tower cyclically, and I look down the tower, I will see the tower twist in a double S curve. I see it, in other words, in between each section, it bows out in the opposite direction. So you see this whole S curve down the tower as you push above, push away and toward, you see the whole tower squiggling back and forth below you. An exciting thing to watch. You soon realize the base of the tower, if it was in a solid chunk of concrete, is trying to move in this S-shaped manner, and the concrete is stopping it from doing that. Well, my Row number 6 tower is a flat plate on top of the lawn, not on a concrete base, and it's got a couple of long rods going through that flat plate into the ground so it can't slide out to one side. In the case of my Roan 55 tower, it's got nothing in the middle except a pin. The flat plate comes down to a concrete pier. The concrete pier has a slight concave shape to it. Convex. It's got a slight bowed out convex shape to it. And it's got this pier pin coming out of the center of the concrete that goes through the hole in the center of the bottom plate. So I have the poor man's equivalent of a zero-moment base. In other words, my four legs of my tower are capable of moving slightly from side to side, so to speak. Not by sliding, I mean by moving in a radial manner. The whole tower at the base is capable of pivoting a little bit away from pure vertical. However, the Roan 55 is so stiff that when I duplicate that same experiment, when I'm on top of the Roan 55 tower, and I push my body as fast as I can, as hard as I can, toward and away from the tower, and I look down the tower and I expect to see it snaking in between the guy station, it doesn't do that. It moves as one solid pencil, and all those guy wires just stretched, so to speak, all in unison, all the guy wires below me. So when you get a modern day tower that's got a lot of stiffness to it, it doesn't have this S curve, and therefore the need for the zero moment base is not as great. In your case, you've got a really big structure with a lot of wind load, and there is going to be a small amount of bending. And that ball on the bottom makes sure that there is no bending moment on the tower. Cyclic bending moments can create fatigue failure. Steel is very forgiving on that. If it was an aluminum tower, you would have an extreme need for that zero moment base. Because the nasty thing about aluminum is it does not have a fatigue limit. No matter how small the deflection is on a piece of aluminum, if you do it long enough, the aluminum will eventually crystallize and go into a failure mode. Steel doesn't do that. As long as you don't go beyond the elastic limit on the amount of bending or stretching of a piece of steel, it'll always come back, and you can do it 1,000 times if you want to. And there's a whole lot of puzzles I've got, physics puzzles on that exact subject. Towers are kind of fun. In my opinion, we all slowly learn, particularly if we're VHF operators, that altitude over antennas makes a huge improvement. The question that Mel and I are very frequently asked is, should I buy this $1 million whiz-bang antenna and mount it near the ground, or should I buy this cheap antenna and mount it up high? A cheap antenna mounted up high, I don't care if it's made out of coat angle wire, is capable of tremendous performance because the way VHF behaves, altitude is everything. You got to clear the trees, you got to clear the local terrain, the buildings, the water towers, and whatever, if you want full performance. That means that if you're a serious operator, you're going to think seriously about buying a radio tower or installing a radio tower. Once you have a radio tower, and I've now had one since 67, so I've had one for 40 years, I've had various radio towers in my possession on my property for 40 years. In fact, in the house I'm in right now, when I moved into this house, the tower went up first before the majority of the furniture went into the house. To me, that's what makes the house into a home. And the wife, who's also a ham radio operator, primarily agrees with that. Not 100% agrees. Obviously, some of the furniture went in, but not all of it. We didn't. The tower construction began within a week of me moving into the house. And the last bit of the furniture that was being transported from the old house to the new house took place a few weeks later. And so owning the radio tower, getting the performance it gives you, looking at the beauty of that structure, standing a block away, a mile away, and looking at that structure is something I get enjoyment out of it. I brag about it. I look at it. To me, it's a thing of beauty. And what it does, it's an extremely useful tool. It's an antenna support structure, ASS. I guess we can make a bunch of jokes about that. But it holds my antenna at a nice high altitude, and boy, does that make a difference. To my knowledge, I'm the only guy on 10 gigahertz that running only 0.2 watt solid-state power from his home, not from remote location, have talked to people on single sideband on 10 gigahertz in 10 states. It's only a simple 2-foot diameter antenna that's doing that. It isn't that the antenna is magic. It isn't that the 0.2 watt of single sideband and 10 gigs is magic. The magic was the altitude. You want the three things that make an antenna work well: altitude, altitude, and altitude. It's the equivalent of what the people who sell real estate say. What makes a piece of real estate valuable is location, location, location. I know we've gone pretty far afield in this one, but maybe some people enjoy some of the information, though. K2KEY, give a little bit of delay in case anyone wants to join us. K2RIW, the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Current final words on it. I just looked at the antenna, ARRL antenna handbook. Just wanted to see what they say here about guide wires. So they stress the HF operation, guide wires, putting up the tower and all guide wires may alter or disturb the radiation pattern of your antenna. So they recommend blah 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 blah, but they recommend to avoid this problem, guides should be broken up by means of egg or strain insulators. Look at figure 29 and they tell you how to go about breaking them up. They recommend it in the book. So I guess you can read the whole story if you want under guy wires, installation of guy wires in the antenna handle. Pretty formative. All right, if no final words, anyone else have any words about any of this above?
Yeah, that is definitely the traditional approach, Mel, to break it up with egg insulators. That is a tradition, and I've got a different opinion on it, and for me, a different opinion works. And as you know, not everyone will agree with me on this one. So it pays your money and it takes your choice. You got it, Mel.
Okay, very good. All right, so let's see. Take a look. What else we got here? Good. Oh, okay. Oh, that antenna question. All right, let's see. What does it say? Are you familiar with the RAIB? Okay. RAI, W7, invented by W7RAI. Yes. It advertised. And he says he has made a major breakthrough in antenna technology, which has not been seen for the last 75 years. He says his beams, I've seen the beams advertised, you know, 20 meters, 20 or 15 centimeters. I heard advertised in one of the amateur magazines. And he says, where was I? He claims that his breakthrough is because of the critical coupling, and that's why his beams provide more gain than any of the other beams of comparable element size. What exactly did he talk about, this critically coupling, this critical coupling? I guess that's what he's asking me, Dick. I don't know. Have any idea what this is all about, over?
I think I do. On a daily basis, I am testing Yagi antennas. I'm doing it at the UHF frequencies, but if you don't want to use a whole lot of hardware and don't want to create a whole lot of aluminum, a whole lot of wind load, it is extremely difficult to beat the performance in pound for pound of a Yagi antenna. 2, 3, 4, or a zillion element Yagi. In most cases, it's going to give you the biggest bang for the dollar. When it comes to the length of the elements and the position of the elements of a Yagi, there's an infinite number of solutions. For years and years, there was a 1956 article written by a company in New Jersey, I can't think of the name of the antenna company, which said that wide space beams give you more gain. It's a good sounding theory, not true. When it comes to where is the performance in the Yagi, you'll soon discover there's a whole host of spacings and element lengths that'll give you a high performance Yagi on at least one frequency, if not across a substantial bandwidth, a few percent bandwidth. So I could make that first director quite close at a particular length, or quite a bit further away in a slightly different length, and in each case I can get pretty high performance out of it. Each of those two cases will give me a slightly different impedance match to the driven element. And as we discussed before, there's a zillion ways of making the driven element give you a perfect match to your particular transmission line, a one-to-one standing wave ratio. Whether that driven element is a dipole, a folded dipole, a gamma match dipole, a delta match, a loop, no matter what it is, square, round, triangular. If you know what you're doing, you can get a perfect match, whether that driven element is all by itself in free space, or whether it's in the middle of a short Yagi, a long Yagi, whatever. If you're smart enough, you can make it a good impedance match. The Yagi itself is a weird mixture of dimensions. In other words, the spacing between the elements, if you're following somebody's design and you make 5 to 10% errors in the spacing of the elements, unless it's not an accumulative error, you will get 95% of the performance out of that Yagi. When it comes to the diameter of the element, you're starting to get into a slightly critical area. When it comes into the length of the element for the particular design, you're getting into a very critical area. In the case of a 432 Yagi, I would like the element length to be with an accuracy of a 32nd of an inch. A 16th of an inch will do. By the time you get to an 8th of an inch of error on 1 foot long elements on 432, you're going to be disturbing the design significantly. Whereas the elements themselves, if you mount them a quarter of an inch in error, some of them forward, some of them reversed to where they should be, you're going to get 95% performance. So element position is not super critical. Element lengths are very critical. Element diameters are somewhere in between. So a good Yagi, when you're copying somebody else's design, when you start making changes in the materials you use, you may use a boom that's a little bit fatter, a little bit skinnier, as long as the elements don't go through the boom. You can make tremendous changes there with no real change in the design. If the elements go through the boom and are in direct contact with the boom, now it becomes a critical area. And it becomes doubly critical because the diameter of the boom better be identical to the design the guy told you about that you're following. And if he's got a square boom and you're using a round boom, that's going to be different. And later on, when the elements start breaking contact with the boom because they build up aluminum oxide, you've got a brand new antenna with brand new tuning, and most likely the gain is lower, and the front-to-back ratio is lower, and the pattern is terrible. So when it comes to more than three or four elements of a Yagi, I'm strongly in favor of the element either being mounted on top of the boom with some kind of a strong structure, or if they must go through the boom, I think they should be insulated from the boom with the shoulder bushing, the so-called insulated Yagi approach, which I think I was a major advocate of that way back in 1978 in the dark ages of the so-called RIW-19 insulated Yagi, which I introduced in 1977 the first time, introduced in 1978, and it became a commercial product then by somebody other than me who manufactured it under my call letters. It became the RIW Yagi, and they elements insulated from the boom is the right way to do it, in my opinion. So, is there a critical spacing for the elements? Is there a critical coupling distance? People believe it. And for a particular design, it will appear to be true. However, I have built Yagis where we had to squeeze them into a small space that didn't have full length, and there are techniques you can use, one of which we've got a patent on, which allows you to make the elements closer than normal and yet get the right coupling coefficient and get the gain to come back. So when it comes to the primary coil and the secondary coil of an IF cam, without a doubt there is a specific distance that gives you critical coupling, that gives you the right shape of the bandpass of the tuning of that IF cam. There, critical coupling really exists. People think that the individual directors of a Yagi are likely primary and secondary coils of a multi-tuned IF can. Not true. A Yagi is not a filter. People think it is. It works by a different principle. So I think you can almost say there isn't a critical coupling distance if you're allowed to change other parameters of the design. On some guys' particular design, like for instance the F9FT Yagi by Franck Tona in Reims, France, and I think he's a silent key. He was using the very first director, which was extremely closely coupled to the driven element, as an impedance matching device. And he's got a patent on doing just that. The first director is an impedance matching device on the driven element. Turns out he didn't have to do that. All he had to do is change the length of the driven element and add a straight capacitance across it to tune out the reactance, and he would have gotten the perfect impedance match. He didn't have to do it with the first director. But in his particular case, because the first director is a critical coupling element of the driven element impedance match, yes, that is a very critical dimension. You make that first director, which is only a small number of inches away in the case of a 432 Yagi, you change that distance by, I'm going to pick a number, an eighth of an inch, which normally would do nothing in that particular design. It's going to make a substantial difference to the impedance match of the driven element. It's not going to change the gain of the Yagi very much, but it's going to change the driven element impedance match. So certain designs do have critical coupling length spacing between the elements. Certain designs do, and the F9FT is one of them. In general, most Yagis are not that critical. K2KEY, K2RIW, that was a bunch of opinions.
Okay, this is K2KEY, or maybe somebody will make a comment. Well, anyhow, this RAIB, I guess say, he makes such claims that the RAIB three element beams as beats any of the other three element type beams on the market, blah blah blah, because he is, says he is the greatest advance in antenna design in 75 years by his critical couple. But I have seen the advertisement, the RAI system, antenna system, you know, he's asking me, is this, you know, worth the price of the antenna, which I think it's a little bit more than some of the other beams that are on the market. So I had tried to ask if you had any experience with anything in that situation, or have heard of this RAI system that they've opened.
While we've been talking, I've been Googling RAI and W7RAI, and I'm getting the impression that the 412 antennas are the RAI design. That's the impression I'm getting here. I may be wrong, but the 412 makes some very nice antennas, VHF antennas, probably UHF, HF antennas also. So 412, why they work August 2005 through December 2006, plus me a series of articles. What is it about the RAI beam that is unique in their patent? The difference is that the RAI said using phase speed at force 12 C-3S. Now I'm getting very skeptical. I work a lot with three-element Yagis. And three-element Yagis, properly tuned, will give you a skosh more than 6.0 dB over isotropic forward gain. 6 dB more than an isotropic antenna. Three elements properly tuned. And I've made some three-element Yagis that are so-called wide space, narrow space. When you make the narrow space, you have to use some other little doodads on the antenna to control the coupling coefficient. So, a Yagi is a number of parasitic elements that each have the right electrical length and the right position in three-dimensional space in the vicinity of a driven element, and the driven element gives you a good impedance match your feed line. You fulfill those criteria. Driven element, give a good impedance match. Driven element, a dipole-like structure, radiating like a dipole. And you put parasitic elements. One of them is longer in general, and you call it reflector, and the others are shorter, and you call them directors. You put them in the right position with the right tuning, and the Yagi will form, will flow. Kintetsugu Yagi, 1927, invented the antenna, along with Mr. Uda. Uda was assumed to get most of the work. Yagi got most of the credit. That's why it's called the Uda-Yagi array among some antenna people. There's a lot of magic in that antenna, and that it gives you a lot of bang for the dollar. And people are led to believe that there's only one design that'll give you optimum performance for a given number of elements at a particular frequency. You study what Gunter Hock has done. DL6W, Delta Lima 6, Whiskey Uniform. Dr. Gunter Hock, Darmstadt, Germany, has spent most of his lifetime studying all the world's Yagi design. He takes everybody's Yagi design, I don't care if it's a 160-meter beam or if it's a 10 gigahertz beam. He boils them all down to a common denominator of 432. He used to, for years and years, put them into the anechoic chamber at the German Federal Post Office anechoic facility near Darmstadt, Germany, where he works. He would take every one of those designs, make a common denominator, scale it to 432, and measure the performance. He's got lots and lots of articles in the German magazine on that exact subject. And so he's come up with a curve and a set of formulas as to what is the maximum gain you can get out of a Yagi that is properly tuned. You tell him what the length of the boom is, and the assumption is you're stacking that boom with the right number of parasitic elements along that length, and his curve will tell you what gain you're going to get if it's properly tuned. And is there only one design for that particular boom length? Hell no. There's a whole series of designs. And if each one of those designs is properly carried out, they all come very close to the same gain. There is no one Yagi design. And for somebody to think they've got a single Yagi design and patent it, I'm starting starting off a little bit skeptical until I find some more information. I wonder if the particular writer has given you a website that we can go to. I've been Googling RAI Beam and W7RAI, and I didn't find as much information as clearly displayed as I'd like to so far. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RAW.
Yeah, K2KEY, yeah, it was advertising. I'm trying to remember, I think it's World Radio or something. The RAI Beam, and they had a whole write-up. I remember I just skipped over one time, you know. Part of the advertisement, and I really don't, you know, remember so many of the nitty-gritty, but I think RAI, W7RAI, he was, they interviewed him, I believe he was a broadcast engineer, and he has said he's been working with, I don't remember, with a couple of the higher engineering doctors that did work with antennas or something like that. It had something to do with something like that. For some reason, I remember mentioning something about Dr. John Mueller, who supposedly was did some expert work in antenna design. I'm sure you're more up on it than I am. But I remember him mentioning something about Dr. John Mueller. I guess that sounds familiar to you, Mr. Mueller.
You said John Wheeler. I wonder if you mean Harold Wheeler. Harold Wheeler, who ran the Wheeler Antenna Laboratory for a whole lot of years. I've had some conversations with him. And he was, to some degree, in competition with Henry Jasek Antenna Engineering Laboratory. And as you know, Henry Jasek was... His organization, his whole company, was bought by Airborne Instruments Laboratory, the place where I worked. Henry became a vice president of AIL, and Henry and I had a significant number of conversations as to what is the maximum gain you can get out of the Yagi. And eventually, Henry and I did lock horns because I was coming up with the 13-element Yagi and the 19-element Yagi at around the time that I was having discussions with him as to what's the maximum gain that was attainable. And where I was starting to claim numbers above what he thought was possible with his construction technique, he thought I had measurement error. And I don't think so. His limitation was he thought all the elements should be welded through the boom, which is a technique that gives you a defined amount of construction conductivity. That's true, but it gives you very little adjustability capability. Very difficult for him to move the positions of the elements and change the length of the elements. I had a different optimizing technique. Also, I was using the ratiometry antenna range technique, which has become adapted. Did I invent it? I don't know. I wrote an article on it in 1976 that became an IEEE presentation in New York City. It became an article in QSC Magazine in the February issue 1976, the ratiometry antenna range. And that technique is now being used by the Realm Air Development Center in Utica, New York. Actually, Newport, New York, is using a ratiometry antenna range. So I was involved in these things, talking to these people, and I've come up with a bunch of opinions that you're hearing about. Do I have the last word on the subject? Of course not. I'm telling you where these are opinions, what they're based on, and you can decide whether or not they're valid enough for you to follow them or go the opposite direction. That's your choice. But Yagi approach. Lots of people want to think that it's a filter. It is not. Lots of people want to think that if you disturb the elements in a particular way, that you come up with a brand new super gain design that's going to have what's called super directivity, higher than normal front to back ratio, better side lobe level. Mr. Seebeck, I can't think of his call letters, W4, who has thousands of pages, by my standards, published on the subject of how we use the modern-day computer Yagi optimization program and tune out all the side lobes. But the feedback is of the opinion that if you make all the side lobes disappear, you're getting maximum performance out of the Yagi. I strongly disagree with that. There is a specific side lobe level that must be present when the antenna has maximum gain for that length of boom and that number of elements. And the first side lobe will be 17.5 dB down. The second side lobe will be 22 dB down. You make that side lobe no sidewalk stronger or weaker than that number, you will have lower gain. The optical people building very high performance telescopes discovered that a long time ago. It's called the Airy Disk Phenomenon. And so the Yagis we built are creating a nearly circular aperture with a nearly uniform aperture distribution. And when you have that, the laws of Fourier series, Fourier transforms dictate the side lobes will be those levels. You can definitely design a Yagi with lower side lobes. And in certain performance areas, like for instance a radar where you don't want to have ambiguous targets on the screen, having the side lobes go to zero is very desirable. But you're sacrificing gain in the process. You're going to have to build more antenna than you normally build to get that amount of gain that you think you wanted if you make the side lobes go to zero. You pay the price. So there's lots of misunderstanding. And that, of course, sounds opposite of common sense. Any normal common sense would lead you to believe that the side lobes of an antenna pattern represent wasted energy. Good sounding common sense, dead wrong. And read a good optics book, like HECT, has a book called Optics. And you read what is the proper side lobe level for a diffraction-limited optical system called diffraction-limited telescope. And the Airy Disk Phenomena will tell you exactly what those side lobes should be, and they will be there on every high-performance telescope. You cannot design a telescope that's going to give you high performance that has no side lobes. Same thing with the antennas we design. So there's lots of misunderstanding. Now, I'm getting the impression as I read the article from the Force 12 company, where they're defending the RAI design. Force 12 is using the RAI design, and the little bit I've read so far leads me to believe that they think they've got some magic there. I'm not so sure, but I'm going to keep reading a little bit further. K2KEY, K2RAW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. I now, I can say it's a fool together, I think, as I can say. I know they had an interview with W7RAI, and I believe, like you say, he went to design antennas or something with Force M squared, you know, and Force 12 Corporation. I don't know what the whole thing was, but there was a whole controversy whether or not this is supposedly this critical coupling idea of RAI is what he's claiming is the, he claims it is the, I remember the article, you know, slightly that he claimed that that was the greatest advance in antenna technology in 75 years. He came up with since Yagi Uba most likely did their original work. Anyhow, all right, that's basically what I believe it's all about. I don't know whether that RAI beam, whether or not it's going to, you know, outdo those other three-element tri-band beams that are on the market by a number of the other companies that advertise. I understand that the M-square is a well-built antenna and things like that. That's true, that they do put it together quite well and will supply good materials. But whether or not their three-element tri-band is superior to all the others, I really cannot say. And I guess Dick, you would agree with that, over.
I think so. As I said, a well-tuned three-element Yagi will give you a little bit more than 6 dB over isotropic, measured in free space. Now, you've got to be careful. A number of manufacturers of antennas have started saying, now, this is the gain you're going to get when you mount it in your backyard, assuming your backyard is a flat piece of land and you're including the ground reflection. Well, the ground reflection and what it does to the pattern of the antenna is an environmental effect. That's not something you can advertise as part of the antenna. That's advertising hyperbole in my mind. That is hyperbole. That's all it is. It is weasel wording. An antenna by the IEEE, Antennas and Propagation Society, has a whole dictionary of antenna terms and antenna testing procedures, and has a number of other organizations that, for instance, the book by Hollis Clayton, by the Scientific Atlanta Company, describing antenna testing procedures that are tried and true. The antenna something you measure in a reflectionless environment, or if there is a reflection in the environment, like a ground plane, or an intentional reflective ground plane antenna range, there's ways that you can tune out that one single reflection, ground plane, and compensate for it, and use it to your advantage. And almost all HF and VHF antennas measured on outdoor antenna ranges are being measured on a reflective range. And there's ways that you can compensate for what the range is doing. So you measure the antenna by canceling all extraneous reflections and canceling all impedance mismatches. Gain is that property you measure of an antenna when there is no standing wave ratio. So to say that your antenna's got better gain because it's got a better standing wave ratio, to say your antenna's got better gain because it includes the ground reflection, is unfair, in my opinion. It makes it very difficult to compare brand A to brand B. So, Gunter Hock has published for years and years his so-called Mipel curve, which is what is the middle gain you can get for each length of boom, for each reasonable number of elements on that boom. He's got a curve, he's got an equation. When you tell me the dimensions of your antenna, and I'll tell you exactly what gain it's going to get. He published that curve for lots of years, and it's been peer-reviewed in lots of countries for lots of years, and nobody has countered it. Nobody has said, hey, Gunter, I've come up with an antenna that's 50% higher than your curve says. Nobody has done that. And so, does the RAI claim that it's doing better than this guy, Gunter Hock, who has spent most of a lifetime studying Yagi? You can tell I'm starting off skeptical. I don't know if there's any additional magic that is patentable, that has been invented along these lines in the last 10 or 20 years. Some of the antenna patents I've been involved in are because we've used different physical construction techniques and different ways of squeezing down the physical size of the antenna and getting almost the same performance and making it physically strong so that it can be bounced on the ground 2,000 times and survive. That literally is one of the criteria for one of the antennas I was involved in the design of. The antenna must be dropped 4 feet onto the ground 2,000 times and survive and still give the performance. It's a handheld product that contains that antenna. The antenna sticks out in front, and the antenna has to be able to survive that physical abuse and for the customer of that handheld product to be happy with the antenna and the rest of the product. K2KEY, K2LAW. How often have you bounced your antennas on the ground, Melt?
Yeah, for trouble. Hope Mother Nature doesn't do any bouncing of my antennas. Yeah, I saw that one. You showed me what you were doing there. It's quite innovative. Extremely well designed constructed, so I can see where it could really take quite a beating. Well, the way you actually were using it, I can see it's going to take a lot of abuse. Okay, very good. I guess we'll let this go. And RAI and the M2 antenna system, and whether or not they have the super tri-band beam again. It's objective, and I don't think we're going to solve that tonight. I don't know, you interested? Should I read on, or should you have enough for tonight to take over?
It's your choice, Mel. I'm in good spirits, so if you want to go forward, go right ahead. It's your choice.
Okay, I'm going to do most of the work. I'm just doing the filtering here. Let me read on. Down here from about, threw out a whole bunch of them here. Came down from 76. I don't know, I think we once talked about this. Control current distribution antennas. What the heck, they want to know control. Let me read this on. Control to read somewhere that there's such an antenna. Oh yes, that control current distribution has. Do they really radiate better than or more gain than a regular dipole? Are they really the hot dipole, even though that they are can be short but still made resonant? And the CCD, will it outwork a regular dipole? I think we looked into that one time, Dick. I don't know why that rings the bell, but control current distribution antenna, CCD antenna, Dick, over.
Again, I'm skeptical. Gain is the thing that we amateurs usually care most about. Second thing we care about is bandwidth and wave ratio.